Every so often you hear something and it makes you realize, man, we need revival in America.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
What a turned around, upside down world we live in, but that's nothing new. Remember in the book of Acts, the disciples in the classic language of the King James were accused of turning the world upside down. That's because they were turning it right side up, but from the world's perspective, it is upside down. This is Michael Brown. Welcome to The Line of Fire. The number to call, 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-348-7884. Love to hear from you on a wide range of issues. Yes, we will give you some political updates. Yes, we will talk about the state of America. Yes, we will talk about the hope of the nation. It does not lie in the White House. It does not lie in the Supreme Court. It does not lie in the houses of Congress. It lies in God's hands, and it is for us, God's people, to be the ultimate change makers. Again, number to call to join in the conversation today as we cover a number of different subjects, 866-348-7884. Also, a heads up, in case I forget to mention this later on in the heat of the broadcast, our School of Cultural Engagement, 6 weeks of classes that we did in special summer sessions at Fire School of Ministry a few summers back with terrific teachers like Joe Dallas and John Rankin and Frank Turek and others. 6 weeks of classes, each class about 7 hours. We've cut the price 80%. And especially by digital download, we're almost giving this away, over 40 hours of classes. So be sure to take advantage of that. Go to the website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org, to find out more and to place your order. So President Obama went to Cuba. This was a historic visit. Donald Trump was unhappy because Raul Castro did not meet President Obama when he arrived on the plane. He did not meet him there. And according to Donald Trump, his main observation about the visit was that President Obama should have turned around and gone back home. That was his observation, because we're not being treated properly. Ted Cruz's observation was this was a travesty, because rather than address the issue of the political prisoners, rather than address the issue of those who are tortured and imprisoned under the Castro regime, rather than address the gross injustices that happen in the country, you have more of a celebratory meeting with others traveling with you. A very different response, I would say, to the Cuba visit. I'm all for building good relationships wherever you can. I'm all for tearing down walls. But you must address issues. Can you imagine how you'd feel as a political prisoner, as someone who was thrown in jail for standing up for your rights or for preaching the gospel? You've been thrown in jail. Perhaps you've been tortured. Perhaps you face a long imprisonment away from your family that's suffering because of your absence. How would you feel if the head of the most powerful nation in the earth, in fact, in the natural, the most powerful person on the earth, comes down to that country and does not say, I will not meet with you unless these prisoners of conscience are released. I will not meet with you unless these pastors and others are released, or sentences against them overturned, or the country apologizes for its crimes. You'd think, what a travesty. So that's why many are concerned about the visit, saying it does more harm than good. It legitimizes rather than addresses problems and calls for change. All right, we come back. I just wrote an article about this. You can read it by going to AskDrBrown.org, checking out latest articles. It's one of those shocking moments that we can't pass by. A shocking moment we can't pass by. Stay tuned.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
We know that legislating morality is constitutional. In fact, you can't not legislate morality. The only question is whose morality. Next question is it enforceable? Can you make people be good? Many people say you can't make people good, so why even try? We tried it with prohibition.
Those are the words of Dr. Frank Turek, part of a class on cultural apologetics he taught for us in our School of Cultural Engagement at Fire School of Ministry. Six different classes, each about 6-7 hours long. Dr. Turek's class on cultural apologetics was just classic. It was terrific. Again, all this week, 80% off the normal price on CD or on digital download. It's all audio, so it's practically a giveaway. Take advantage of it. You will be super equipped and edified. 866-348-7884. I read this story last week, and I was surprised that it didn't get more of a national outcry. And I want to draw attention to it because I'm constantly saying, and I have said for many years, we must have revival in the church, and it's revival in the church which can lead to moral and cultural revolution. It's not either or, it's both and both are absolutely essential. And America is in very bad shape, morally and culturally now, in many, many ways, especially in our inner cities. And especially when you look at the relative innocence at times past in our society, the relative stability of the family in times past in our society. Again, just go back to the old programming that I grew up with and you grew up with. If you're my age, I'm 61. You know, shows like Leave It to Beaver and Father Knows Best and Lassie, and contrast that with the programming today, not just for today, but for years. And that reflects the degeneration of our society. All right, so in Miami, 17-year-old teenager Trayvon Johnson was shot and killed by a female homeowner after he had broken into her home. She was at work. Her security system alerted her that there was a break-in. She came hurrying home. She had notified the police. She apparently encountered him on the way out. Don't know exactly what happened. She shot at him, and he was killed. A tragic loss of life. Tragic that a 17-year-old is breaking into a home, of course. And family members were very upset. One of his cousins said, look, she already called police. Why did she need to shoot him? She could have just waited for the police. Now, obviously, there's no guarantee that the young man would have just stayed and waited for the police. And who knows what happened? And in the intensity of the moment, who knows exactly what happened? The homeowner is cooperating with police, and no charges have been filed as of yet. But there is something else that his cousin said. Now, please hear me. I am not playing this clip in mockery. I am not playing this clip in ridicule. There is no justification for what the young man did. And there is no possible justification for his cousin's words. But I want you to hear what she had to say, because it exposes something absolutely tragic and pathetic that is in our inner cities today, be it black, white, Hispanic, Asian. The color of the skin, the ethnicity is not the issue. It is the tragic breakdown of the family, which creates an environment in which a quote like this can even be made. Listen to what she had to say.
You have to understand, you have to look at it from every child's point of view that was raised in the hood. How he going to get his money to have clothes to go to school?
Whoa. Did you hear that? Let's just play it one more time. He was breaking into the house, and his cousin says, you have to understand growing up in the hood, the way a child is going to think. Listen once more to what she had to say.
You have to understand, you have to look at it from every child's point of view that was raised in the hood. How he going to get his money to have clothes to go to school?
Oh, boy. Now hear me again. I am not playing that clip for you to mock the sister or to mock her dead cousin. That is not my intent. Nor is it my intent to say that everybody in, quote, the hood, or most of the people, young people in, quote, the hood, think that way. And in no way am I making this a racial statement, all right? Because there are problems in the inner city due to the breakdown of the family, be that family a black family, a white family, Hispanic family, Asian family, whatever family, all right? I am saying that as a wake-up call to us as Americans. I'm reminded of an account in 2 Kings, the 6th chapter, where the king hears word. He's on the city wall, and he hears one woman coming because there's a siege on Samaria, the capital of northern Israel. And one woman says, well, look, we killed my son, and you know, my neighbor and I killed my son and ate him yesterday, and now today we're supposed to kill her son and eat him, and she won't. And when the king hears that, he's so grieved, he tears his garments. That quote to me should have that kind of effect on us, that in our great country of America, with all of our liberties, with all of our freedoms, with all of our wealth, with all of our power, with all of our influence, with all of our technology, with all of our creativity, that we could actually be at such a state in society that there could actually be such a breakdown of life in parts of our own country. This is our problem. That's how I see it. That we could get to this point. It is mind-boggling to me. Now look, some of you might just say, that kid just needs to learn how to get a job and go out and work. Oh, okay, I understand that. I understand the principle. I understand if anyone doesn't work, shouldn't eat. I'm also assuming he was raised in a fatherless home. Don't know that for sure, but assuming that he was raised in a fatherless home with a couple strikes against him, maybe without seeing an example of a male in his household or in his immediate family working a job and making a living and moving ahead. I do not say that to condemn. I say that to sympathize that some of us were raised in a way that made it much easier for us to succeed, and others in a way where it's much more difficult. Now look, I know there are some who believe that the whole welfare system was yet another attempt by some white Americans to keep black Americans enslaved, and that this was a way not to lift them up, but to keep them down. I know some who believe that. I know others who think that's utterly outrageous. Whatever the cause of the problem is, Professor Walter E. Williams, African-American himself, professor, respected economist and intellectual, he pointed out in an article last year that the breakdown in the black family is utterly unprecedented. Whether it's society keeping black Americans down, whether it's a vicious cycle, God knows, all right? I'm not here to point a finger either way. I'm here to say, let's be burdened together. Let's take this quote as a wake-up call that things are worse than most of us know or understand because most of us don't come from similar backgrounds. And therefore, this should break our hearts and cause us to pray and say, okay, God, there's got to be a solution. There's got to be some type of holistic solution. There's got to be some solution of evangelism, discipleship, and holistic ministry. I thank God for churches laboring in the inner city. I'm saying let's be praying together and figure out ways to help together. No, this is nothing new. This is nothing new. And I'm not Johnny come lately as if, well, I never heard about this. I'm simply saying this grabbed me. This got my attention. Professor Williams points out that in the early 60s, when illegitimacy went up to 25% in black America, that was a cause for great concern. If you go back to earlier in the 1900s, these families were much, 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 much stable. In fact, Williams says that a study done during times of slavery showed that the great majority, about 75% of kids born into slavery, were born to their mother and father together. raised together during the horrors of slavery. So something tragic has happened where illegitimacy is about 75%. Now, again, I am not pointing a finger. I'm saying this is something that should get our attention together. This is something that should burden us together. This is something that should get us on our knees saying, oh God, we need awakening. And our inner cities need awakening. And we need wisdom, a holistic approach to solve these problems, which are our problems as America together. Do you hear me? Are you with me? Let's pray. Let's cry out. Let's do what we know how to do. And let's stand with those who are trying to make a difference.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I can't believe. Are you sure he's a Mormon? Are we sure?
I'm Presbyterian. I mean, Seventh-day Adventist, I don't know about. I just don't know about.
I've never seen anybody that lied as much as Ted Cruz. And he goes around saying he's a Christian. I don't know. You're going to have to really study that.
All right. So switching subjects now on The Line of Fire. That was Donald Trump. And Donald Trump was questioning whether Mitt Romney is actually a Mormon or not. And previously, he had questioned Ben Carson's faith. And then he had questioned, of course, Ted Cruz's Christianity. And when the Pope questioned his faith, he said, that's wrong. It's wrong for any leader to criticize or question the faith of someone else. So that was interesting. Of course, I pointed that out, that on the one hand, Donald Trump had no problem questioning the faith of other candidates and leaders. But when the Pope said something about his faith, he was immediately offended. That's not right. Well, I want you to hear something, friends. I want you to hear something. I continue to find it absolutely ludicrous that people are flocking around Donald Trump as if he is this great leader. Now, you say that's insulting millions of people who voted for him. I'm just being honest with you. I'm just being honest with you. When I listen to what he says, it is often complete gibberish. It is nonsense. It is many times blatant lying from one day to the next, complete reversal of positions. And the fact that this is taken seriously and that there's this personality cult so many are buying into, well, it doesn't matter if he's vulgar, it doesn't matter what character flaws he has, it doesn't matter that he can't clearly state a policy, it doesn't matter that he changes his tune from one day to the next, he's going to get the job done. That, to me, is worrisome. It's not how you elect potential president of the United States. So now, right before the Utah primaries, he's questioning whether Mitt Romney is really a Mormon. So George Stephanopoulos is talking with him. This was yesterday, this week, with George Stephanopoulos on, ABC. And I want you to hear this interaction. And please listen carefully. Please listen carefully to what Donald Trump has to say. We go to clip number 9. Again, George Stephanopoulos questioning Donald Trump.
After the Pope spoke out about you, you said that no leader should question another person's faith. So why do you keep on doing it?
Well, with Mitt Romney, I was saying to the Mormons are very smart people, and I said it in a joking way, but they can take it any way, you can take it any way you want. The Mormons are very smart people. I know many Mormons. I don't think Mitt Romney is a smart person. I never have thought he was a smart person. But the Mormons are very smart people. So I said, you sure he's a Mormon? And I'm not going to change it because I think Mitt Romney has proven to be not a smart person. As far as Ted Cruz, he's one of the greatest liars and biggest liars I've ever known. He lies about so much. He lies about things that he shouldn't be lying about. He lies about things that don't matter. So I tell people.
All right. So listen. Please hear this. Please hear this. He says, is Mitt Romney really a Mormon? He claims he's only joking. He says, take it however you want. What's his alleged reason for saying it? Why does he say it? Please, if you're a Trump supporter, listen carefully to what he said. Mormons are very smart people. Mitt Romney is not smart. So I'm questioning whether he's really a Mormon. This is idiocy. This is complete nonsense and idiocy. This is not the talk of someone that you want to be the leader of the free world and the most powerful elected official in the world. That's sheer idiocy. And then he goes on to bring up once again the false charge that Ted Cruz lied about Iowa. Just keep saying it enough. He lied about Iowa, and he got thousands of votes in the process. Number one, Ted Cruz did not know. He was in the midst of caucusing. He did not know what a campaign staffer did, sending out a notice based on a CNN report. CNN poorly reported that night, as I and others have carefully documented, and they owe the Cruz campaign and Carson an apology. Staffers, one campaigner and then someone else, based on CNN reporting, sent out notices, which from what we can tell, did not affect the election at all, saying that Carson was taking a break from his campaign, which is what was reported, and then that Carson was dropping out. That was incorrect. We have yet to hear of anybody switching votes. There is no evidence whatsoever that it affected the election one iota. And the moment Senator Cruz heard about it, he immediately apologized privately to Ben Carson and then agreed to apologize publicly, taking responsibility. In contrast, you have two incidences now where Donald Trump's campaign manager is implicated in assaults, grabbing someone, pulling someone's collar at one of Trump's rallies. Charges are being pressed in one case. I'm not sure if they're going to be pressed in the other. And this just fine. And hey, these are bad people. We got to get rid of them. And whatever excuse is being thrown out. This is dangerous stuff, friends. When people believe double talk, when they believe lies, when they believe outright cons, that's dangerous. And I'm really not concerned whether I might offend someone in saying this because I have a duty to speak the truth. I have a duty to raise my voice and speak the truth as much as I can. I raised my voice during the candidacy of Barack Obama. I warned you as to what was coming if he was elected, and I hoped that I would be wrong if he was elected, and he was elected, and my warnings came to pass. And he was the most radical and is the most radical pro-abortion, pro-homosexual activist president we've had in our history. And the results have been disastrous, let alone other concerns we had in terms of it being weak towards Israel. So it may have offended some listeners, but I'm not here to win brownie points. I'm not here to entertain. We don't spend all the money that we spent, millions of dollars over the years, to be on radio broadcasting. To reach as many people as we can. We're not doing that. Our team doesn't go through the joint effort and sacrifice together to be on the air with you to tickle ears or to win brownie points or to get people saying, oh, I love Dr. Brown. Hey, I am so blessed to hear from so many of you who do love me. I am so thrilled to hear from so many of you whose lives have been blessed and changed and helped. That's why we're here. We're here to serve you. But if what I speak offends some, let it be, because I'm not here to avoid offense. I'm here to speak the truth. Please consider what you're doing. Step back and pray and get God's heart and get God's mind before you vote. And don't just get caught up in, well, the prophecies about this, that. You know how many prophecies were spoken about this president and that president that didn't happen? And you don't vote for someone based on who you're hoping they will be. You vote for someone based on who they are and who they've been. Make sure you check out our extraordinary offer this week, 80% off our School of Cultural Engagement at askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to the Line of Fire broadcast. This is Michael Brown, 866-34-TRUTH. We'll go to the phones in Washington, D.C. Terry, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, good afternoon, Dr. Brown. I have a brief question on people commenting that Donald Trump might be the man for the hour. The scriptures that I use most of the time are Old Testament scriptures. And my understanding is that the Lord was speaking to the children of Israel when he raised up wicked kings to discipline them and to bring them back to him. And I'd like your comments on how this relates to the United States.
Yes, a very fair question, Terry, and you're absolutely right. People will point to, or they'll point to a positive passage like Isaiah, the end of 44 and into 45, which speaks about Cyrus, who was a pagan king, but God used him to bring the Jewish people back to the land and rebuild the temple, even though he was a pagan king. So some might think, well, God, how could you do that? How could you use a pagan to rebuild the temple? But that's what he did. And others would point to maybe Nebuchadnezzar, who was a wicked king that God raised up. That was to discipline and destroy Israel or the Jewish people. So you would say, all right, how does that then apply today in America, which is a democracy? Obviously, Terry, there's not a direct application. The only application would be that God is sovereign and that God may raise up someone that is ungodly, raise up someone that doesn't know the Lord, but raise that person up to bring blessing to America or to do good. And certainly, God has, the power to do that. God is sovereign, and he's the ruler, and he sets up kings and removes kings, so that means he sets up presidents and removes presidents. But how exactly it's going to work out? Could it be that God is raising up Donald Trump to judge America? Terry, there was a terrific article written by a Presbyterian pastor who said that evangelicals who support Trump, many of them are showing not what they believe, but what they love. And a lot of what we love is kind of the superstar mentality. A lot of what we love is the, you know, the bigger, the better, the glitzier, the whole personality cult, the carnal prosperity, as opposed to righteousness. And it's kind of an indictment on us, an indictment on the church, in that we are voting for someone in that sense who can get things done without us having to humble ourselves and pray and repent. In other words, the standard shortcut that we're often looking for in the church, whereas that could be a recipe for disaster. So you could use the argument and say, hey, God's raised up pagan kings to bless before, but normally when he raised up pagan kings, it was to destroy. So if God's raising up Donald Trump, it could be to judge America as opposed to bless America. And that's a grave concern that I have.
Thank you, Dr.
You are very welcome. Thank you for the call. 866-34-TRUTH. Joseph in Medford, Long Island. Time is short. I've got a break, but what's your question, sir?
Hello, is this Joseph?
You are Joseph.
Are you answering me? Yes, Joseph Manning?
Go ahead.
Joe. Okay. Yeah, so there's two things, and then the first one, well, before I get to the two questions, if everybody's watching, get a pen and paper down, and I'll get back to that, what you want to write down. Yeah, the condition of the country, we need to get back to the Bible. It's not church that saves us. John 14:6, Jesus said, I am the way, not the church. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Now, the first two questions.
Yeah, tell you what, we've got a break here. I've got a guest coming on. If you can stand by, great. Otherwise, we'll have to get to your info a little bit later in the show or the week.
God of light, hear our cry. Send the fire. It's It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to The Line of Fire, 866-348-7884. We are going to have a very important conversation about a very important and often misunderstood subject, often referred to as Seven Mountain Theology. Critics refer to it as Dominionism. It's come up a lot today because people will say, how can you endorse Senator Ted Cruz? He and his father believe in Dominionism, and they think he's the anointed one that's supposed to reign as a king over America. I'm thinking, what in the world are you talking about? Where are you getting this from? So I have some friends that are very familiar with this teaching or flow in those circles. And I was looking for someone that could come on the air and have a useful, edifying, biblically-based, intelligent conversation. I thought Oz Hillman would be a great person to do this. He's the author of TGIF, Today God is First, and The Upside of Adversity from the Pit to Greatness. He's founder and president of Marketplace Leaders Ministries, an organization whose purpose is to train men and women to fulfill their calling in and through their work life and to view their work as ministry. An international speaker has written 12 books, but it's the first time that he and I are speaking face-to-face, so to say. Oz, welcome to The Line of Fire. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael. Great to be with you today.
Well, it is a joy. Obviously, there's a lot we could talk about in terms of your background and your organization, and we can get to that in a bit, but there's so much talk, normally critical, normally from an outsider perspective, about, quote, Seven Mountain Theology, and critics call it Dominionism. You have written about the origins of this, and I think it would surprise a lot of people. Where does this teaching go back to?
Well, I think it goes back to 1975 when Dr. Bill Bright of Campus Crusade for Christ and Lauren Cunningham with Youth with a Mission met each other for the very first time, and it just so happened that week that the Lord spoke to both of them and said, you know, if you're going to impact the culture for Jesus Christ, then you're going to have to influence these seven areas of culture that most define the culture, and that's arts and entertainment, business, education, family, government, media, and religion. And it wasn't a theology per se, nor was it a dominionism. It was simply a strategy that says, you know, most of society and people's beliefs are formed in one of these seven areas or more, and that if we're going to have an impact on the culture, then we have to raise up young people that can be representative of heaven on earth in these core areas.
All right, so this goes back then not to some conspiratorial, charismatic preacher trying to build some empire and take over the world, you know, whoever that person might be, but to some of the most respected figures in modern American Christianity, Bill Bright and Lauren Cunningham, both with a tremendous heart for world missions. But what they both felt God was saying to them in the mid-70s was, you need to have an influence, you need to make an impact on arts, entertainment, media, education, etc., not just in the realm of religion. So is that what is continued to be taught as if we call it mainstream Seven Mountain Theology, that the church should have a positive impact in every area of society?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, and I think that some of this came out of when in the 90s we really saw an emergence of the whole faith and work movement where, you know, God was helping people in the workplace say that your mission to the workplace is as important as any vocational ministry. And that so we were basically getting a more biblical view of our work life, which I believe was at the right time to understand the role of the seven cultural mountains. Because the other thing about the seven cultural mountains is that we realize that it only takes 3-5% of a leadership at the top of these cultural spheres to actually shift that cultural sphere. And, of course, the best case study we have of that is the gay rights movement, which is less than 3%, that totally shifted America's view of that issue from being a moral issue to being a civil issue by going into arts and entertainment, media and education, and then government. And, you know, they shifted how their strategy by, you know, having sitcoms created, writers in Hollywood, doing movies and totally shifted the public's view of that issue. And so here you have a very small percentage of people shifting a major cultural issue by using three of these spheres and then going into the rest of them.
Do you think, Oz, that some of this beginning in the 70s may have been a reaction against the mentality of Jesus is coming any moment and we're out of here, so the best thing to do is just kind of win everyone to Jesus and get out of here and don't think about making a lasting impact on culture because everything's going down and we're going to be gone?
Oh, there's no doubt about that. You know, we had the Left Behind series that sort of put in the minds of, I think, Christians that, you know, well, it's all going to heck anyway, and we we might as well, you know, just, you know, protect our own ship and let the world go where it's going to go. But when Jesus prayed the prayer, the Lord's Prayer, he prayed that heaven would come on earth. Now, that's not dominion theology. That's the Lord's Prayer saying, I'm desiring that you, as my representatives, bring heaven on earth. And that doesn't necessarily mean we're going to transform every city, but he does tell us to come and represent his interest on the earth.
All right, so it's one thing to say we want to establish a theocracy. We want to take over and force everyone to submit to our religion. And if you don't go to church on Sunday, it's 100 lashes. And if you don't tithe, you go to jail. I mean, some primitive mindset like that, which I personally don't know anyone that holds to anything like that. I'm painting it in the most extreme way. But that's the way some critics do. I saw some website referring to conservative Christians as far-right terrorists and referring to me as leading the American Taliban. So you have people with these crazy, crazy ideas and misperceptions of who we are. But there's a difference between a theocracy where you have religious leaders ruling over a country and enforcing religious law, like you have, say, under ISIS or even in Iran or Saudi Arabia. It's polar opposite to say, hey, we want to bring the principles of the gospel into every sphere of society and have a positive influence as salt and light. Why is it that we constantly get accused of dominionism or trying to take over?
Well, Michael, I think we fail many times in the media in the words that we use. I think it's dangerous to use a word in our modern society of dominion, because mm-hmm. that connotates takeover, you know, yep. and society reacts to that. And, you know, when God used that word in Genesis 1:26, it was true. It was, you know, Adam and Eve did have dominion. But today, you know, it's just not the same. And I think the better word is influence, because he's called us to be salt and light. And that's really what Jesus talks to us more about than anything, is being salt and light and representing his love on the earth. And when I wrote my book, Change Agent, I came to realize that culture change is a fruit, not a goal. And you really see that in the life of Jesus, who came, and every person he came into existence with, he solved a problem. And so when he solved the problem, the fruit of that was influence. And every time he solved a problem, he had more influence, and his influence grew. And I think that culture as a whole wants their problem solved, and they don't care who solves their problem. They just want their problem solved. And if we, like Joseph, can solve a problem, or like Daniel and Nehemiah, they solved the problem. When they solved that problem, they had greater influence. And I think that's the model that we as believers in society should really model.
All right, so give me an example of what that would look like in America today in the economy.
Well, you know, in the marketplace, we're seeing a lot of, you know, I remember Henry Blackaby saying, you know, I don't see leadership in any place other than the marketplace. And if you look at what Hobby Lobby did, and you look at Chick-fil-A, here were people that got really attacked because of their biblical positions on things. But as a result of that, they've had great influence because they won those battles, and they did it in the right way. And so I think that, you know, whenever we have anyone who takes a position biblically and not sacrificing their beliefs, but also having wisdom about how they represent themselves in the media, it's really a great opportunity for Christ to be uplifted in a in a right way and standing for righteousness.
Yeah, and again, why should we just abdicate everything to the devil? We live and work in this world. My guest is Os Hillman. To find out more about great resources he has, including a free daily email devotional, Today God Is First, go to marketplaceleaders.org. So one word, marketplaceleaders.org. You can also connect with other workplace believers around the world, find out about their change agent network and other things. So marketplaceleaders.org. I've got a bunch more questions for Os Hillman on the other side of the break.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
We often hear the term dominionism, the idea that the church is supposed to, quote, take over the world, take over the society, and then somehow force everyone to obey biblical principles. Now, there may be some who hold to that teaching. No one that I work with, no one I've worked with for decades, no one I associate with anywhere around the world holds to that. But there are many who believe that we should have, virtually all that I work with would say, yes, we should have a positive, life-changing influence on all of society. So as the gospel spread through ancient Rome, the gladiatorial combat stopped. Infanticide stopped. As the gospel had its course in America, in Great Britain, slavery ended. These are things that you would simply expect as the gospel is moving forward. My guest, Os Hillman, has a great website, marketplaceleaders.org. He's written a dozen books, including TGIF, Today God Is First, and The Upside of Adversity, From the Pit to Greatness. Os, if you could just tell our listeners again the seven mountains that Bill Bright and Lauren Cunningham were burdened to influence, just breaking down society into seven different areas. What were those seven mountains?
Sure. They were arts and entertainment, business, education, the family, government, media, and religion. And of course, the church would be included in that. And they felt that, you know, if we were going to impact culture, then we've got to influence those areas because they tend to have the most impact upon people's formulation of their values, and that those areas could really shift people's opinion of, their worldview.
Right. So I couldn't imagine any Christian who would say it's better that people are watching The Sopranos than Lassie, for example, or it's better that the economy is trillions of dollars in debt than we have a balanced budget. In other words, we would all agree that some things are better than others, and yet sometimes it doesn't dawn on us that we're the ones that are supposed to make things better.
Well, that's right. It is ironic that people want to go, you know, this other direction with this and think, you know, get distracted by the idea of dominionism versus just really being representative of Christ to help fulfill the Lord's prayer of bringing heaven on earth. Even Jesus didn't transform his entire culture. He transformed pockets, you know, when you look at his relationship to the Samaritan woman at the well, and it says that he went into the city and ended up staying 3 days because of the people received what he had to say. But it doesn't say that Jesus, you know, transformed all the cities that he went to. And so I think that in itself is something that we need to learn from, that we are going to have, you know, impact, but that doesn't mean we're going to have dominion over everything on the earth.
Right. And let's focus on the issue of marketplace ministry. A lot of Christians think, okay, I'm a layman, I don't do ministry. So there's an unbiblical mentality of a clergy laity distinction, something we don't find in the New Testament, where we're all priests, all sons and daughters of God, all members of the body, all branches of the vine. But there is this mentality, okay, I go to my workplace, I try not to get involved in the sin on the workplace. Maybe I can share the gospel with a colleague every so often. I make my money to provide for the family, and then I take some of that and give it to the Lord's work. And that's all commendable. That's all wonderful. That's all honorable. But perhaps that person thinking like that is missing something in terms of God's calling. What would you say to them as a leader in marketplace ministry?
Yeah, well, Michael, this whole problem goes back way, way back. In fact, there's another Aus named Aus Guinness who wrote a book called The Call. And in that book, he tells us that there was something that happened in 300 AD called the Catholic Distortion. And what that said was they were trying to promote the fact that this vocation is spiritual and this is not spiritual, that there's a hierarchy in the area of spiritual work. And so they secularized work. You know, the Bible doesn't even talk about secular work. All is spiritual in the Bible. And then in 1200 AD, something called the Protestant Distortion came along, and that said that work is a place to collect a check instead of being a calling. It's a vocation instead of a calling. And so that further removed us away to the point that many of us in the workplace feel like second-class citizens spiritually, instead of realizing, based on Colossians 3:23, that whatever you do, do unto the Lord. It is the Lord Christ you are serving, and therein is your inheritance. So even the word work and worship come from a root word, avodah, out of the Old Testament. And so God, you know, loves work. He, you know, Jesus worked until he was 30 years old as a carpenter. In fact, he was known more for that than anything else. And then Bezalel, the Old Testament character that created the Ark of the Covenant, was handpicked by Moses because God told him to go get Bezalel, who had great gifts and that he was filled with the Spirit of God. One of the first men in the Bible talked about as being filled with the Spirit of God. So work is spiritual.
Right. So, again, I go back to the 1800s. When a similar mentality was prevalent that if you're really spiritual, if you're called, then you're called to be a pastor. You're called to the ministry. You're not called to be a judge. You're not called to be a school teacher. And again, that brings this strange mentality that only those doing, quote, vocational ministry are called and everyone else just has a job. So we've just got about a minute and a half. What would you say, and again, friends, go to marketplaceleaders.org for lots of resources, including a daily devotional you can receive that will bless you, daily email devotional. But what would you say to someone who just says, well, I'm just working a job, man. I don't really feel called. What would you say to that person?
Well, I would say that they have reduced God's value of them and also their own call, because God doesn't see them that way. He sees them of wanting them to bring the presence of God in the area of your calling. That's why when God came to Moses at the burning bush where he was out sheep herding, he said, now take off your shoes or you're on holy ground. Well, what made it holy? It was the presence of God. So we don't check the presence of God at the door when we go to work every day. We need to realize that he wants to manifest his presence in the area of our calling, and that's so important for us to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. It is, friends. And if we could take hold of that, look, as God raises up Christians in Hollywood, as God raises up Christians in the economic sphere, as God raises up Christians in every aspect of society, think of the good we can do. Think of the life we can bring. Think of the hope we can bring. Think of the health that we can bring, because God's ways are ways of life. Every follower of Jesus is called to service. The question is, what aspect of service is it? Whatever it is, let's give ourselves to it as a holy calling. And again, friends, go to marketplaceleaders.org for lots of practical resources. Oz, I appreciate you taking time out to join with us. Thanks for the edifying words and the good work.
Thank you, Mike. God bless.
God bless you. My bottom line today, find out what God would have you do and do that little well, for what is great and what is small, as only God can tell. Yeah, the whole world is going crazy, but we're not going crazy here. We're keeping our sanity on the line of fire.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, welcome to The Line of Fire. 866-34-TRUTH is the number to call. This is Michael Brown. I'm delighted to be with you. And I'm making a slight change in some of my plans today. And I'm going to open up the phone lines wide. Don't normally do this on a Monday, but I'm going to. Any question you want to ask me, anything you want to raise, put on the table for discussion. Anything you need clarity on, any biblical, theological, moral question, go for it. I'd be delighted to speak with you, 866-348-7884. If you want to differ with me, today would be a great day to call and do so. I've got a bunch of things I want to discuss with you, 866-348-7884, number to call. But I want to lay something out before you. It is one thing to say that Christians should take over the society and enforce God's laws on society, and Old Testament laws at that, stoning of adulterers, burning of witches, and things like that. That's one thing, and I absolutely, completely repudiate that from the heart and based on the New Testament. It's another thing to say God's ways are best, and we want to advocate for God's ways as based on the whole testimony of Scripture, so not just the Sinai Covenant, but the whole testimony of Scripture. We want to advocate for God's ways in every area of society, believing that those ways are best and will produce the best lasting fruit. Hence, the importance of advocating for God's ways in society. For God's ways of life in the womb, for God's ways of life and care for the elderly, for God's justice for immigration, wherever that falls, for God's justice and compassion, for God's way for the family and for marriage. These things are best for society, therefore we advocate for them. I had a guest on a few weeks ago, Dr. John Rankin. Does he have his PhD? He's a brilliant guy. He probably could have earned several PhDs over the years, but a brilliant guy, great thinker. And he did a series of classes for us a few years back, about 7 hours of teaching called Only Genesis, where he showed us that the foundations for all human life and society are found in the opening chapters of Genesis. Joey, grab clip number 2. This is part of a 7-hour class, which is part of over 40 hours of teaching that we're almost giving away today at our School of Cultural Engagement. We've dropped the price on this resource 80%. Digital download or CDs to listen to. Listen to what John Rankin has to say. Clip number 2.
Remember the chief priest. Their job for the Passover lamb, for the atonement lamb, is to examine the lamb to make sure that the lamb is what? Free from any defect, a perfect 1-year-old male from the best of Israel's flocks. And where does that examination take place? In the temple courts, in public. What has Jesus just done? John the Baptist called him who? The Lamb of God. He's come into the court of the Gentiles. The chief priests lead the prosecution of him. They whose job it is to examine the lamb for sacrifice. When they silence themselves, what had they just declared? You are blameless, a lamb fit for sacrifice.
John Rankin teaching Only Genesis. Fascinating, fascinating insights. Go to my website now, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. This week only, the entire School of Cultural Engagement. Teachers like Joe Dallas, Frank Turek, each with 6-7 hour classes, 80% off. The price is low to start, so you want to take advantage of this. Each class is terrific for yourself, for your church, for your Bible study.
Fire we want, for fire we please. Send the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I'm here to confess that I was wrong. I made a mistake. And I humbly come to you to say sorry.
That's the voice of Rosie Rivera. Not sure what happened to my voice. There we go. There's my voice. That was the voice of Rosie Rivera. She is a television personality, current CEO of Jenny Rivera Enterprises. And she was saying she was wrong. She says it with great humility. She says it with great compassion. What was she wrong about? She was wrong to attend a gay wedding. She absolutely speaks with love to those who identify as gay or lesbian. But she says she was wrong to attend. And when you attend, you are there as a witness, and it was wrong, and she won't do it again. So we're going to hear a little bit more of that in a little while. Hillary Clinton spoke earlier today at AIPAC, that is the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Donald Trump is scheduled to speak. Ted Cruz is scheduled to speak. And I'll tell you what, as much as I'm a critic of Hillary Clinton, I like a lot of what she said in her speech because it was strongly pro-Israel. And, of course, critics on the anti-Israel side are absolutely blasting her. But she actually is going after Donald Trump, who's pledged neutrality. And there are rabbis, I don't know how many it's going to amount to, rabbis and Jewish leaders who are actually going to walk out on his speech peacefully. Not so much because of his ambiguous position on Israel, but because of the character of who he is. They feel it is a fundamental violation of principles of ethics based on Scripture. And as a protest of who Donald Trump is, they will be walking out on his speech. So the plot continues to thicken. 866-34-TRUTH. I've opened the phone lines wide. There are a bunch of things I want to cover, but I'm going to open the phone lines for any question under the sun you want to ask me as well. So with that, we go to Paul in Des Moines, Iowa. Thanks for calling The Line of Fire.
How you doing there today? The question
Good,
I got for you, I don't know how well your Hebrew is, but I phonetically is all I can do with it. I don't have all the nice nuance in there. But I was looking up the word in Greek about Judea, and it seems to be spelled out phonetically as like idiom or something like that, where the Italian or Latin would be idios for God and stuff like that. Is that how it's kind of...
No.
Say that in the Hebrew?
No. You're getting that wrong. The Greek does not have a Y sound like you have in Hebrew, okay?
It has an I sound is what I'm saying.
Right. I'm trying to explain. It does not have a Y sound, so you have to put a couple of letters together to get something equivalent. So, for example, the Hebrew name for Jesus is Yeshua. Yeshua is the Hebrew, whereas in Greek you say Jesus because you do not have the equivalent of a Y. So the same thing when it comes to in Hebrew, okay, the land of Yehuda, which is Judah, that's the way it was originally referred to. A Judean was a Yehudi in Hebrew. And then in Greek, it is just spelled to get that equivalent sound without the Y. That's the reason for it.
I was looking at the letters of how it would be pronounced using phonics.
You can't use phonics because phonics is a system that we're using based on each letter having a certain value, whereas the pronunciation of those letters in Hebrew or Greek had different values.
Well, I understand that. I was just looking at when people utilize different transliteration of sound to make it match up. It looked like it almost matched up the same thing in English, the way we'd get the word idiom or ideology or design.
No, I'm saying it's completely unrelated, 100% unrelated.
I was going to say it's kind of interesting because I was looking at how God described things in the Old Testament about the first.
Yeah, but it's completely unrelated. But sir, it's unrelated. The spelling is totally different in Greek than to those words.
I got that. I was just looking at the picture of it. If I was to see a picture of the explanation of something, and how.
But there's God, no. But right. But why would you be looking? If I say elephant, that does not give you a picture of a car. If I say worm, that doesn't give you a picture of a spaceship. So that's what I'm missing.
Okay, that's what I'm saying. I'm trying to. It worked out well in my mind, but now I'm trying to convey it. It's like Judah means Lord is praised, isn't it?
No, right. It just Yehuda just means praise, right?
Okay, it does mean praise.
Yes.
So I was looking at the first commandment God gave was in the Ten Commandments was the praise, and commandment was for God Himself. Correct?
No, it's not. It's not to praise. It's to have no other gods. Yeah, I see what you're trying to do, sir. It does not. It does not use the word praise. Yeah, you're trying to do stuff that doesn't work. Okay, so just trust me. I'm fluent in biblical Hebrew. Studied it for over 40 years. Yeah, it what you're trying to do, with all respect, doesn't work. So best to come at it differently and let Hebrew be Hebrew, let Greek be Greek. All right, and I think you do better in that respect than trying to kind of make it work and put it in English like that. But hey, thanks for the effort. Glad to be of help. 866-348-7884. We go over to Charlotte, North Carolina. Christy, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi. If you don't mind, I'm going to just pose my question and then hang up and listen to your answer. I'm just having trouble with my cell phone. So
sure.
My question is, I'd love to hear your salvation story, number one. And number two, I have a very dear friend of mine who I would love to share the gospel message with, and she is Jewish, and I was wondering if you had any words of wisdom. I specifically was interested to know what your turning point was and what that aha moment was. So
sure thing.
If I could pose that and just sit back and listen, I'd be very grateful.
You bet. All right. Thanks, Christy. I appreciate it. Number one, I do have a website which is just for Jewish outreach called realmessiah.com, realmessiah.com. So you'll find lots of good resources there. Also, here's a website, and I just recorded my testimony for this the other day. It's called ifoundshalom.com, ifoundshalom.com. The testimonies are not that long to listen to, maybe 5-8 minutes. And men, women from all different backgrounds, some who were very religious Jews and some who were nominal, and all of these Jews who came to faith in Jesus, ifoundshalom.com. And if you watch them, you'll probably find someone that's very similar to your friend. And if I could recommend one book that I've written, if your friend is willing to read and look at it, one book that I've written, it's called The Real Kosher Jesus. The Real Kosher Jesus. I think you'll find that very helpful to understand for yourself, and hopefully your friend would be willing to take a look at it. The Real Kosher Jesus. All right. In my own life, even though I was bar mitzvahed at the age of 13, I was not a religious Jew. That was more of a social event. We were more nominal Jews, the equivalent of Christians who would go to church on Easter and Christmas. You know, I went to synagogue for the high holidays. That's when I had to go. And then I had to go to Hebrew school, and I was bar mitzvahed. But I didn't have this great love for Judaism. I knew I was Jewish and was glad to be Jewish, was proud of it, but didn't have much depth behind it, certainly very little spirituality behind it. When I was 13, I went to my first rock concert and saw Jimi Hendrix in concert, and that was a more impacting event on my life than my bar mitzvah, to be honest. At the age of 14, I started getting high because of my interest in rock music. Remember, it's late 60s, early 70s, and that whole culture sucked me in. By the time I was 15, I was a heavy drug user, shooting heroin and other drugs, and at the age of 16, continuing on that path, playing drums, going to rock concerts, getting high, that was my life. My two best friends, who were not Jewish, got radically born again. their testimony impacted my life. I went to pull them out of a church. I should say they were beginning to come to the Lord and then really got seriously saved after. I went to pull them out, and the Holy Spirit began to convict me of sin. So in my own life, the first thing was deep conviction of sin when people were praying for me and I didn't even know it. Conviction of sin, and then the recognition that Jesus really died for me and that God loved me enough to not leave me in my sin. That's what radically transformed my life in 1971 at the age of 16 and a half. I have that all in my testimony from LSD to PhD, which you can watch on my website. Now, how it is that I came to recognize the Jewishness of Jesus, I'll explain on the other side of the break.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
So let me finish up my own salvation story in answering a question from a caller. I'd also say, in terms of advice, be a friend, share your own testimony, express your great love for the Jewish people, and in doing so, let this woman know that God's done something very different in your life, something very real in your life, and hopefully spark an interest in her life. So for me, in all candor, because I was not a religious Jew, my biggest issue was pride, having to say I was wrong. My next biggest issue in coming to faith was drugs, having to give up drugs and my whole lifestyle. My next issue, and a distant third, was I'm Jewish, we don't believe in this. It was a big issue for my dad. When I came home and told him my life has radically changed in this whole bit, he said, well, we're Jews, we don't believe in Jesus, and asked me to meet the local rabbi. And the more I talked to the rabbi, the more I studied, the more I looked at things, the more convinced I was that Jesus was the one who fulfilled prophecy, that Jesus was the one who was our Messiah, and that by believing in him, I was being faithful to God and faithful to my Jewish people. There's a terrible history of anti-Semitism in the church. Professing Christians have persecuted Jews, even put them to death for not believing in Jesus. And because of that, many Jews think, well, I'll be betraying my people, betraying my God, betraying my ancestors if I believe in Jesus. What we need to show is no, Jesus is Jewish. All his first followers were Jewish. The New Testament is written almost all by Jews, and therefore, there is nothing un-Jewish about following him. In fact, it's a very Jewish thing to do. And hopefully those resources I mentioned will be of help as well. The I Found Shalom website, lots of testimonies. And then my own Jewish outreach website, realmessiah.com. Before we go to some more calls, let's listen to what Rosie Rivera had to say. She attended a same-sex wedding ceremony and afterwards issued this heartfelt apology. We'll go to clip number 6 next.
Last week you heard me say that I do not believe in gay marriage. I stand by what I say. I do not believe in gay marriage. And I'm in the process of learning what that means. Because although I embrace and I love my friend Elena, some of my family members, some employees, everyone that is gay that I know, I love them. But because I love them and embrace them does not mean I have to agree with their lifestyle. But I should also not be badgered, not be called homophobic because I don't agree with their lifestyle. What was I wrong about? I shouldn't have gone to the wedding. But it wasn't your bullying. It wasn't your insults. It wasn't anybody's name calling that made me realize I was wrong. It was God himself. And that's the difference between having a relationship with the living God and seeing him as my father, a father who can discipline me with love. In our moments alone, he could tell me, with love, Rosie, you shouldn't have gone to the wedding.
Yeah, So she felt that God spoke to her and said what she did was wrong. And I want you to hear just a little bit more of what she has to say. I love the spirit behind it and her forthrightness and the evident love that's in her words. One more clip. Again, it's a little bit over a minute long, but take a listen. Clip number 7.
I thought that going to a wedding was that you were a guest at a celebration, but that's not true. In the Bible, the way a wedding is made is that all the people that are there are not guests, they are witnesses. And when you are witness to something, you are agreeing to something. I didn't know that at that point. I was going to my friend's wedding because I love her. And I wanted to show her that my belief and my relationship with God is not going to separate us. I still love Elena, but I probably should not have gone to her wedding. And in the future, when a friend, when an employee invites me to a gay wedding, I will not attend. I will still love them. I will embrace them, but I won't agree with their lifestyle. You may not like that. I'm not here to make you like me. You may not agree with it. I'm not trying to make you agree, but I do have a right to say my point of view. I say it respectfully and with love, and your attacks and your badgering and insulting did not make me change my opinion.
Yeah, I appreciate her doing that. And if you listen to the whole video, she reaches out with love throughout. You might say, well, there's no such thing as a homosexual lifestyle. What she means is a man marrying a man or a woman marrying a woman. That's what she's talking about. So I appreciate her doing that. I appreciate her humility, her forthrightness, and her love in the midst of it. All right, we go back to the phones in Raleigh. We don't go to Raleigh. We go to Chesterfield, Virginia. Susan, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yes, Dr. Brown, I certainly enjoy your show. I just get so much out of it. And thank God for wonderful people like you, pastors, that give the Lord the true word of God. But I have a question, and I hate to say this, but I'm like the woman before me. My phone's giving me problems, too.
That's fine.
Getting to go down on it. I have one little bar left. But I'm questioning this. You may have spoke on it before, and I missed it. In Matthew, where it says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. I listened to another pastor last week, and he gave me the impression that you could have been born again 10, 20 years ago and can lose your residence in heaven, basically, and not go there. And I was always under the assumption that once you were baptized and you accepted the Lord Jesus, that you went to heaven. And you're judged when you get there, but you go to heaven. So I wonder if you could maybe clear that up for me. And
sure
I would really appreciate it. Thank you. I'm hanging up now. Thank you.
All right. You bet. All right. So keep listening on radio right there. Yeah, this is a question we get all the time, the question of, quote, once saved, always saved. There's a lot of controversy on it. But let's face it. The New Testament is filled with warnings to believers not to depart from the faith. You say, well, God does not make you a son or a daughter and then unmake you a son or a daughter. Yeah, but you can leave the house. You can leave the house if you want. You can disown the family. So, Susan, God's promise to keep us safe, God's promise that nothing can pluck us out of his hand, God's promise that nothing can separate us from his love. Therefore, I rest secure in that every day of my life, knowing the power of his salvation and knowing that he'll never fail, that he'll never leave me or forsake me. At the same time, I understand that I could commit spiritual suicide. I could choose to turn my back on God and walk away and never come back and deny Jesus as Lord, in which case I would be lost. So Matthew 7:21 is true. A true believer will follow Jesus. And if someone willfully ceases to follow him, willfully turns away from him, willfully denounces him, that person does not belong to him. And Jesus said, if you deny me, I will deny you. It's the truth.
Change the world. It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, so this is some of the latest presidential drama. Presidential election drama. This is Michael Brown. Welcome to The Line of Fire. There was supposed to be another debate this week on a debate held by Fox News that would now have the Republicans down to three candidates, John Kasich, Ted Cruz, and Donald Trump. Donald Trump said, "Now we've done enough debates. I don't want to do another debate. Plus, I'm scheduled to speak at AIPAC." AIPAC is a very, very influential pro-Israel group in America. It stands for the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Donald Trump said, "I'm scheduled to speak, so it's not going to work." Was it Monday night? "I'm scheduled to speak." Well, hang on. Ted Cruz is also scheduled to speak and said they can have you speak anytime. We can do the debate without a problem. Nah, not going to do it. Well, John Kasich always complains he doesn't get enough airtime. Well, during the debates, he doesn't get asked enough questions. Well, Kasich and Cruz can just have it out. Kasich dropped out. So Ted Cruz said to Donald Trump, "Let you and I have a debate one-on-one. I'll come to D.C. I'll come to where AIPAC is. We'll do the debate. Let's do it." Of course, Donald Trump has not responded to that invitation. I'd love to see it. I'd love to see a head-to-head debate between Ted Cruz and Donald Trump and get into real substance and probe issues and things like that. I'd love to see it. Well, now they will each appear individually tonight on CNN. They'll be interviewed individually. So CNN now takes this away from Fox. I mean, this whole thing's just like a joke almost. And instead of a debate, they can do it this way and not be confronted the way they would be during a debate. The plot continues to thicken. At AIPAC, Hillary Clinton spoke and gave a very strong pro-Israel speech that would make her much stronger pro-Israel than Barack Obama, if she held to her words, if she was elected, and basically is contrasting herself with Donald Trump, who kept talking about neutrality. And Donald Trump had this to say. Joey, grab clip number 10. He was on with George Stephanopoulos on This Week, yesterday, and Stephanopoulos wants to ask him very directly about where he stands on Israel. And if you want to hear a really bad answer, again, if you're a Trump supporter, this should trouble you. This lack of substance and even stereotyping, this should honestly trouble you because this is the man you're supporting. So listen to this conversation, quite revealing.
There is nobody more pro-Israel than I am, but you'll hear what I say at the speech, and we'll see what happens.
What kind of a deal would be in Israel's interest?
I think making a deal would be in Israel's interest. I'll tell you what, I don't know one Jewish person that doesn't want to have a deal. A good deal, a proper deal, but a really good deal. But I would say it's probably one of the toughest deals. Me being a deal maker, it's probably one of the toughest deals in the world to make because there's just so many decades of hatred between the two sides. It's probably one of the toughest deals to make if you're a person that prides yourself on being able to get people together.
So what does a good deal look like, though? Will Israel have to give up some land?
I think it's something that we should try very hard to get. And I don't know any Jewish people that don't want to make. They'd all love to see a deal made. No, they want to have a good deal, not an Obama-type deal. They want to have a good deal made.
Oh, gosh. I could never get away with that in a debate. I could never get away with that before the media. A student of mine on a test could never get away with an answer like that. And that's the best answer. It's very, very revealing. And there is a substantial group of rabbis and other Jewish leaders that plan to walk out during the Donald Trump speech, not so much because of his Israel policies, but because of his character. They are insulted by his very character. We'll be right back. 866-34-TRUTH. Change the world.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us on The Line of Fire. I did this last half hour. I'm going to continue it now. Phone lines are wide open. Anything you want to ask me, any subject with any area of expertise I have, anything you want to differ with me on, probe me on, 866-348-7884. Biblical, theological, Israel, moral, cultural. Give me a call. We didn't even talk about the NCAA tournament. No. I'm not going to talk about that. Okay. Before I go to the phones, just this 20-second clip from Hillary Clinton. It's clip number 11. She's on Fox News, and she's obviously taking a swipe at Donald Trump's Israel policy. Clip number 11.
Yes, we need steady hands. Not a president who says he's neutral on Monday, pro-Israel on Tuesday, and who knows what on Wednesday, because everything's negotiable. Well, my friends, Israel's security is non-negotiable.
Okay, so that was at AIPAC, obviously what the people at AIPAC want to hear, but I think probably reflects her views. Could be wrong on that. And that was played, that excerpt, on Fox News. 866-348-7884. We go to Charleston, South Carolina. Luke, welcome to The Line of Fire.
Hello, Dr. Brown. How are you today? Can you hear me?
I can.
Hey, Dr. Brown, this is such an honor. I've read so many of your books, and you've taught me so much. You are by far my favorite theologian, so it's so great to talk to you today.
Thank you.
Dr. Brown, so I had two things I want to share with you. One is a question, and the other is just an experience I recently had, but I don't know how much time I have, so I really want to get the question out, but I can share the experience with you as well if you want me to do that first.
Let's go with the question first.
Okay, sir. So the question, Dr. Brown, is why is the church not teaching young people today that they are married once they have sexual intercourse? It seems to me that all the examples we have from the Bible, biblical times, are that a couple are married at sexual intercourse. We never see any example of a prophet, of a priest, apostle, or even the Messiah himself ever doing any sort of ceremony or requiring somebody to commit vows or some such thing. All the examples we seem to have are that a couple are married at sexual intercourse. That's why there's no such thing as premarital sex in the Bible. There's either keeping the marriage covenant or breaking the marriage covenant once you are linked in that covenant. I just want to know what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah, with all respect, I look at it differently. First, in both Hebrew and Greek, you have the word for fornication, which is in most cases premarital sex. Adultery is sex outside of marriage. So you're married and now you have sex with someone else, so another married person. But fornication would be two people sleeping together outside of wedlock, and you even have laws in the Bible when that happens. And it can refer to prostitution or harlotry, but most of the time it just means fornication. So the Bible does speak of that with an explicit term, and there are even laws that relate to it. So if a man sleeps with a woman and she cries out for help and no one helps her, you know, she's raped, then the father can say that there'll be a fine that is paid, or they could say, no, you've defiled her. Now no one else is going to want her. You have to marry her for life. But the sexual act itself would not make them married. And you do have, you know, the wedding at Cana, and then you have after, you know, wedding celebration with Jacob, then he's given his wife. So the sexual intercourse would then consummate the marriage. Now, ancient Judaism taught that there were three ways to acquire a wife. So one way was with a dowry, you know, with the wedding payment, and you had that was common in the ancient world, another part of the ceremony. Another was with the vow, I take you as my wife, and the other was intentionally with sexual intercourse. In other words, saying, okay, we are now married and come together. But that was certainly not the law, that if any two people had sex, they were automatically married. That's why it was premarital sex. That's why it was fornication. That is another sinful behavior that God comes against. So the only difference would be that if two people officially came together and said, okay, with this act, we are now joining together as one and married for life, then the act of intercourse would signify that. But that was certainly not some universal custom in the biblical world. And in most cases, you have the wedding, you have the celebration, you have some formalizing of it with some type of public ceremony or witness. Just because the Bible doesn't record them, it certainly does record the celebrations that took place, and that would speak of some formalizing in a public way.
Yes, sir, and I agree that you should certainly, it should certainly be acknowledged to the public that the couple are married, that they are together. But I would just ask, what then is the mechanism in the Tanakh, in the New Covenant scriptures of the actual marriage? Because there's nothing. It seems to me, sir, that what we're following today is human tradition. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the tradition. I'm not, because I believe the vows are a summation of the marriage covenant of what you should do and what you will do,
right?
Once you two are united. But I don't see what the mechanism to me is what the Messiah said. You know, what God has joined together, let no man rip apart. And before that, it's the two will become one flesh. And it goes back to Genesis, and I read that as you have Adam and Eve, and they joined together in sexual intercourse, and they were married at that point. And I see it with
Abraham, you had two human beings who was going to perform the wedding, and who were going to be the witnesses to it. You had only two human beings. The answer to your question is in the question itself. There was no one fixed way, because this was across cultures, because every culture has a different ceremony. Every culture has a different set of witnesses. Every culture has different vows that are taken. So there is no one formal way, except that there is the acknowledgement of a lifelong commitment to one another, which is then consummated by coming together. But the act of sex does not make a couple married in Scripture. It absolutely does not. And that's why, again, you have words for premarital sex, fornication. Which is different than adultery, which is sex committed by someone that's married. So if you had two teenagers, two 18-year-olds sleeping together, they're not formally married because they did. They've sinned with each other. They're guilty of fornication, but they're not formally married simply in the act. And the reason that we don't have more detail is because it varies from culture to culture. And each culture is going to have their own way of doing it and their own laws surrounding it.
Okay, that does make sense. That does make sense. I would ask one more follow up question with that.
Sure thing, sir.
I really appreciate you talking. This is phenomenal to me. So in Corinthians, when the Apostle Paul is speaking out against the believers uniting with the temple prostitutes, and he says, "Do you not know that when you do that, the two become one flesh? And would I unite Messiah with a prostitute? God forbid." It seems like that's the overt teaching there as well. The two have become one flesh at that point. And there certainly wasn't a marriage ceremony with that. That was the act.
Right. So in other words, the act does join you with another person. That's correct, but it doesn't make you married to them. So that's where you're having that one leap. Yes, a married couple now becomes one flesh by joining together sexually, and that's part of the act of marriage. That is the consummation of it. If someone in that couple joins himself to a prostitute, he's become one flesh with someone else now. So, yeah, the sexual act joins you together in one flesh. It doesn't make you married. And yes, a married couple is joined together as one flesh. That's why it's so sacred. That's why the one thing that could break that marital contract is joining together to be one flesh with someone else. It's a fundamental violation. So I absolutely see where your logic is going there, but it just took one extra step beyond the logic there. But listen, okay. I appreciate the questions, and appreciate very much, Luke, the kind words. Very meaningful to me. I'm so glad we could chat for a couple of minutes on the air together. All right, 866-348-7884. I've got a break coming up, so Brent, you will be next. And I commented earlier in the hour, it was a little late to get the audio clips for radio, so we didn't do it today, but I commented earlier in the first hour, the response of Ted Cruz and the response of Donald Trump to President Obama visiting Cuba. Donald Trump's gripe was that Raul Castro didn't meet him at the airport. And when President Obama found out he was not being met at the airport by Raul Castro, he should have turned around and gone back, because that's not how you get respect. But that's it. That's the policy critique. Ted Cruz was quite eloquent about political prisoners, those tortured dissidents of Fidel and Raul Castro's communism, and how those needed to be the focus of the visit, as opposed to the Pope going and the president going, and from what we know, not focusing on those issues and on those who were mistreated by communism, instead making this almost celebratory. The difference in critiques tells you about the difference between the two candidates, the truth be told. We'll be right back with your calls.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Excelentísimo señor presidente, la Guardia de Honor está formada. Jefe de la Guardia, Teniente Coronel Peraza López.
Solo queda.
Cuba in the news, a whole lot to talk about there. Obviously, a lot of criticism of the president's visit, a lot of praise for his visit. We've talked about a little on the show today, but right now we go back to your calls starting in Durham. Brent, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, how are you, sir? I enjoy your show very much.
Thank you.
I had a question. I kind of know the answer, but I'd like to hear your version. You know, I've offered, and I'm sure there's many of us Americans who would offer to join the Israeli Defense Force in time of need, you know? Hmm. But I spoke to someone at one of the consulates, and they said that they won't accept anybody from outside of Israel that's not Jewish. I mean, I figure they would, you know, I guess because they don't trust. I think that's what it is, for one thing, I guess.
But I'd be more than happy to, there are a couple things, Brent. First, I really appreciate your heart. To serve and to help, that's admirable. And remember, Israel receives a tremendous amount of monetary aid from America. This is a great, great help to Israel in terms of being able to defend itself and have weaponry and things like that and develop the Iron Dome, etc. Israel is also, and there are Americans who move to Israel and become part of the IDF, okay? They move there, they become Israeli citizens, and they join the Israeli Defense Forces. But Israel's very glad to say that no foreign serviceman has died defending Israel. No foreign serviceman has died in the defense of Israel. And here's the other thing, right? Here's the other thing that in other words, no one on their soil has come and fought their wars for them. The other thing is, everything is in Hebrew. There are certain things expected and required where people understand Hebrew and understand what's going on. And if you don't know Hebrew, it's going to be very difficult, the integration into society. It's a very, very tight-knit group. And remember, all young men coming right out of high school, unless they go right into the Israeli military. So they've already been in the military 3 years before they go into college. They're more mature then. The women serve for 2 years. So it's kind of a rite of passage as well. But Israel is very glad to receive technological help and military help in terms of finances, but they feel the responsibility of fighting their own wars in that respect. But thank you very much, Brent. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, if it was up to me, I wouldn't give aid to anybody but them.
Yeah. Hey, yeah,
serious.
Well, they are.
Dr. Brown.
Yeah, thanks so much. Listen, we care about all the nations, but Israel is our number one ally in the Middle East for many reasons. Let's go to Dallas. Tracy, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. I just wanted to make a really quick comment about the question that the first caller had about the one flesh, as that the scripture that he referred to. What I've experienced in learning more about the soulish realm is that that can be a soul tie. And I think that that is where the confusion, or not the confusion, but the maybe just needed to be expounded on a little bit more to help him understand why it says one flesh. I've had to have deliverance in the past myself from relationships that were ungodly. And how they led me in deliverance was to break the soul tie, because it's a tie. You're knit together in the soulish realm, not spiritually, like in a married relationship, but in the soulish realm. And so that's why God forbade or wanted us to just wait for that one person that he has for us, because he knows how that can just mess you up mentally and have all of this baggage that you carry into the relationship that is, you know, that he has ordained. And so I think that that may help him understand that it's a soulish tie that is the knitting of the one flesh that the scriptures refer to.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of aspects to that, Tracy, and I appreciate the point you're making. First, let's recognize there is something very powerful that some do refer to as a soul tie, where even if you've not had any physical relations with another person, your souls get intertwined. You are
exactly
almost addicted to each other in that respect, to just say, okay, we won't have any contact. We won't call, we won't email, we won't write, we won't text. It's almost like withdrawal, and the people have to break it. Sometimes they need outside help. It's almost like you got to be delivered from a stronghold in your life. So that can be very, very powerful. You can be married to someone and have a soul tie with someone else that you get close to that you shouldn't. And when it becomes this obsessive, oppressive thing, you're in big trouble. That's not the
right
kind of thing that just...
There are good soul ties, too. Jonathan and David had one,
oh, yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely right. There are many that are good and healthy and right. And, of course, when you have a healthy relationship, say, with your spouse, your lives are totally intertwined, but it's not a negative, oppressive thing. But take it one step further. If you have that tie with that person and then have a sexual act where you physically come together as one, it really intensifies everything. There is something that happens in the joining of two people together in that way. And
sure
it was
does.
Meant it was meant to be significant. In other words, it wasn't meant that someone has 20 or 30 different sexual partners. It wasn't meant that as you said, that you've played the field, you know, slept around before you get married. It was intended that we kept our sexual purity before marriage. And then once married, we're married for life. Now, here's the good news. Jesus' blood cleanses. So maybe there's some folks listening, Tracy, and they say, man, I blew it already. I'm still single, but I've slept with a bunch of people. God can cleanse you. God can wash you. And when you get married, you can get married in purity, and you can live in purity for the rest of your life. But yes, Tracy, both the physical tie and the soulish tie, that deep emotional tie can be very, very powerful. And when they are out of wedlock, very, very destructive. If something like that is growing in your life, cut it now. Cut it off now. Don't play with it. Don't play with it. It'll be a monster that you won't be able to control. Thank you, Tracy, for the call. Hey, Joey, grab clip number one. As we're coming to the end of the broadcast, I want you to hear from my friend, Dr. Frank Turek, one of the top apologist, one of the clearest, most enjoyable speakers, and really able to hear the objections and answer with clarity and with wisdom and with knowledge. Clip number one.
We know that legislating morality is constitutional. In fact, you can't not legislate morality. The only question is whose morality. Next question is it enforceable? Can you make people be good? Many people say you can't make people good, so why even try? We tried it with prohibition.
All right. Great questions and great points from Frank Turek. He taught this class about 6-7 hours on cultural apologetics at a special school of cultural engagement we had at Fire School of Ministry a few summers back. Other great teachers, Joe Dallas, taught on sexual purity. Just a terrific roster. 6 weeks, over 40 hours of teaching. The price is unbelievably low to start, but we're cutting it by 80% this week. It's almost giving it away. Take advantage. Great, great life-changing classes. Go to Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org, to find out more. My bottom line today, the marriage covenant, the sexual union, coming together as one, these are very, very sacred things not to be tampered with.